Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, we're recapping 2016, all the major stories from this past year. We'll also be offering up our picks for underplayed story of the year. Plus, we'll be talking about the Tribune's choice for Utahn of the year. Joining me on the show today, Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Good morning, Jennifer. Thanks
for being morning.
Here. Good morning. Deputy editor Tim Fitzpatrick, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And welcome. Senior managing editor Matt Canham, glad to have you in studio again as well.
Thank you very much.
And also managing editor David Noyce, thank you for being here, Dave. Good morning.
Hi, thanks.
The end of the year is a time when a lot of news organizations make lists of the most influential, the most important stories that played out across their pages. Dave Noyce, you compiled a year's review for the front page of the paper this past week. And in an election year, I imagine that some of the decisions about what made the cut for your list were kind of decided for you. But generally, how did you decide what made the cut and what kind of criteria were you operating under?
It's a very, very scientific process of me wading through. I wade through every single paper for the year, the front pages of the A1 and the Utah Front, and just start writing down things I see. Mm-hmm. I'm looking mainly for some stories are, like you say, no-brainers. Others, you have to search a little bit more. I'm looking for stories generally that have some sort of lasting impact. Mm. There certainly are some really big stories that happen just once and they don't happen again.
Right.
We had one of those yesterday, as a matter of fact, with the death of Lavelle Edwards. But otherwise, that's what I do. I go through that. I run them past several editors. Tim Fitzpatrick, for one, is one I always have take a look at it from our opinion page to see what I may have missed or what I should include.
Yeah, Jennifer Napier-Pierce, this is the essentially the need-to-know Utah news from the past year. But I think to make a distinction, it's not the most popular news or the most clicked on or the most shared news. It's kind of the news that mattered most.
Absolutely. I think Dave's selections really do capture those stories that have lasting impact. It's not just sort of the fly-by-night stuff that happened. And as you can tell, we talk about Bears Ears, we talk about Maddie Barney, we talk about the homeless situation, a lot of things that are certainly going to extend into 2017.
As well. Well, I want to dig into some of these stories, talk about the momentous things that happened this year, the political battles fought, even the people we said goodbye to this past year. But first, a reminder to our listeners that we'd like you to join us for this conversation with your questions and comments. What news mattered most to you this year? We are at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. You can also comment at the Salt Lake Tribune's website, sltrib.com. I think that the story that most dominated the headlines here and everywhere this year was the election. And of course, in Utah, that story had some unique elements. Matt Canham, senior managing editor, I came up with some unique elements to that include Evan McMullen, Mitt Romney, the Mormon Church. These are all parts of it. But maybe let's actually start with Mitt Romney. And before I ask you a question, I'm going to play a short clip. In March, before Donald Trump had secured the GOP nomination, Romney gave a speech here in Salt Lake City that was picked up by national and international media. And in it, he gave a strong warning about a potential Trump presidency. Here's just a taste of what he had to say.
His domestic policies would lead to recession. His foreign policies would make America and the world less safe. He has neither the temperament nor the judgment to be president. And his personal qualities would mean that America would cease to be a shining city on a hill.
There's Romney, the GOP nominee in the previous election cycle, strongly criticizing the man who is now the president-elect. Matt Canham is calling this unusual, putting it a little bit mildly.
Yes. I mean, I don't even know how far you'd have to go back to find the last nominee of a party demolishing the, you know, who ended up being the current nominee. And he did it not just then. He did it throughout the year. He was here back for he has a gathering every summer in Deer Valley of political and business leaders. And in that instance, which happened well after Donald Trump became the nominee, he said that he worried about trickle-down racism if Donald Trump was elected. His criticisms of Donald Trump spanned all the way until Donald Trump won. and then how Mitt Romney responded to this changed significantly.
Mm-hmm. Well, Romney, of course, after the election, pops up again as a potential pick for Secretary of State, as we see, and he makes nice with Trump.
Right.
And I guess despite this previous criticism, which is a remarkable part of the year, it's hard to go back to the beginning of the year and see Romney at that time and then see the change that happens without kind of thinking that something momentous in between must have happened.
You know, there's a lot of speculation you can go into why Mitt Romney would at least consider taking a job, the job that was never actually offered to him. They had conversations, but Donald Trump did not offer him the job. But the hard part is, I mean, we're not in those conversations. Mitt Romney has been gracious to Donald Trump afterward, including to a letter to the Salt Lake Tribune saying that he, you know, thought it was an honor to be considered, and said that he has high hopes for what Donald Trump will do in his next administration. But yes, there is a huge tonal shift. There is a tradition.
Gracious, but not effusive, though.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's not going over the top.
We do have a tradition in this country of giving our next leader some deference, even if it's someone you disagree with. And I think we saw that with George Bush's response to Barack Obama. I think we've seen that with Barack Obama's response to Donald Trump in many ways. So Mitt Romney might have been operating in that mold, too.
You know, I want to stick with the kind of Utah elements of the presidential election. Back in October, there was the video that surfaced that showed Trump making some, people say, disparaging comments about women and suggesting that he could essentially get away with a kind of sexual assault because he's rich and famous. And we saw this very serious turn away from the candidate, an exodus that was led by many prominent Utah Republicans. And we should say Mormons. In fact, the Mormon church-owned Deseret News weighed in on the election, something that it hadn't done for something like 80 years, which was kind of stunning. I'm not certain who to throw that to.
Well, I covered that day, and it came up at about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, the Access Hollywood tape, where you could see Donald Trump from speaking in a hot mic from 2005 saying what all of us would consider to be lewd and inappropriate comments, if not comments that talked about criminal actions. And it took a second just to hit because it was so unusual. And then we started reaching out to Utah politicians. John Huntsman was one of the first ones to say that Donald Trump should drop out of the race. Mm-hmm. Jason Chaffetz then went, talked to us as well as other media and said that he could no longer support this nominee. It then went to Governor Gary Herbert. And by the end of the night, there was about a dozen prominent politicians in this country who had already disavowed him. But it started here in Utah, which was fascinating. And it was not hyperbole. It was acknowledged by media throughout the country that this turning point, this reaction to this Access Hollywood tape, was stronger here than anywhere else.
The turning point that in some ways didn't end up being the turning point that that many expected. I want to get back to just for a second the Deseret News editorial in which they they took a stand against the candidates. They called it hucksterism, misogyny, narcissism, and latent despotism. This wasn't the Mormon Church saying these things directly, but the press vehicle that it owns. And was that, I mean, how big of a deal was that, Jennifer Napier Pierce, editor of the Salt Lake Tribune?
It was a pretty big deal. I mean, I don't think that they've ever done that before. They've shied away from any sort of political endorsements whatsoever throughout their history. So I just, it was absolutely significant. Breaking opinion, as we call it, Tim, right?
Breaking punditry.
I love it. Well, you know, there's a lot we could stick with on the election here. I think that another big player here in Utah, of course, was the entrance. Was when Evan McMullen came onto the scene, an outsider candidate. He popped up seemingly out of nowhere, but he had to come from somewhere. And again, I guess I'll go back to you, Matt Canham. I know you wrote a biographical sketch of Evan McMullen. What was he doing with his coming on to the political scene?
He is definitely a guy who came out of nowhere. He was a staffer in the U.S. House, focused on foreign policy, worked for the House Republican Conference. I asked Utah's members of Congress what they knew about him. The answer was nothing. He was not exactly a big enough player that our delegation had even heard of him before. And yet in August, he announced he was going to run as an independent candidate for president. And he got some initial attention, but it started to brush off. But he actually started catching fire here in Utah. He's born in Provo. He's went to BYU, but he really doesn't have a lot of more immediate ties since he left college. And yet he spoke like a Republican traditionally speaks here in the state of Utah. He talked about conservative principles in the U.S. Constitution. He talked about limiting the federal government and boosting states' rights, things that you did not hear Donald Trump talk a lot about because he is not the normal Republican politician. And so for those Republicans in Utah who were looking for an alternative, Evan McMullen became that person. And he spiked in the polls. He actually led in one of them. He tied in a bunch. And then faded at the end.
Right. There was this period of time where he looked like he would be, he would challenge Trump as the you know, the alternative, and that would sway the outcome in Utah, especially given the fact that he was a member of the LDS Church, and there was kind of some congealing around him. But yeah, as you said, in the end, that just
we were a legitimate swing state for a while there. Major political organizations and media organizations of this country did not know which way Utah was going to go for the first time in I don't even know how long.
Can anybody here, I mean, does anybody here remember
think.
Any instance similar?
On the presidential level?
Yeah. Yes. Anytime we've even been in the conversation before.
Not in my time at the Tribune. Three decades.
You know, maybe you go back to Nixon, Kennedy. I don't even know how close that was in Utah, but yeah. It really basically, no. We haven't had a close race for ever.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
And we didn't have one this time either, frankly, in the end.
In the end. Yeah.
You know, one kind of, I think, fascinating side note about the election this year having to do with Donald Trump. At one point, he had called for a ban of Muslims entering the United States. We learned that former Utah Senator Bob Bennett, on his deathbed, apparently, reportedly asked to apologize to Muslims, kind of on behalf of or for Donald Trump, for the comments that he had made in this election cycle.
And not just him. You have Senator Mike Lee, who replaced Bob Bennett, who's not exactly on the best terms with the senator he replaced, also highly criticized Donald Trump for his comments about Muslim Americans, his intention of blocking their access to our country. And so I think what that shows is that there were a lot of Mormon politicians who feel very strongly about religious freedom, and it goes beyond their religion.
And interestingly, that's another place where the Mormon Church weighed in. As an institution, this time officially, they issued statements denouncing that and saying, of course, looking at Mormon history and the persecution that's part of their legacy, calling out Donald Trump on that, not by name, but certainly the implication was clear.
And still they sent the choir.
Still they sent the choir. And there's, of course, news that's been breaking on that, which is really interesting, the resignation of one choir member who doesn't want to perform at the inauguration, Trump's inauguration. We could rehash the presidential election, I think, through the whole show, but and it almost feels like the election year hasn't come to an end yet and will go on forever. But there are a lot of other stories from this past year. Maybe just sticking with politics for a moment longer. Let's talk about some history being made. Misty Snow, the first transgender person to get the nomination of a major political party for a U.S. Senate race. She was the Democrat running against Mike Lee. She didn't fare well, but she did, again, she made some history this year.
I think she surprised a lot of people just in the breadth of her knowledge. I mean, if you look at her resume on paper, there were not very high expectations. And yet when she came out on the stage and held her own against Senator Lee, I think a lot of people were very, very impressed with how prepared she was, with her enthusiasm, her idealism. I wouldn't be surprised if she finds herself in the political arena again.
Yeah. She, full disclosure, she's my grocery store checker.
Is she?
At Harmon's, yes.
Nice.
And this is a person who went on to make history. No one, I mean, there's nothing, like you said, that saw that she could claim that distinction, that she would be able to do that. And certainly in the debate, she's not a polished politician by any means, but certainly very aware of issues and had, interesting ideas, very much mirroring some of the things that Bernie Sanders said.
And probably part of the appeal not being a politician. I mean, aside from breaking making history as the first transgender nominee from any of the political parties, she could be the first grocery store clerk, as
exactly.
you were just pointing out, which is really interesting. I'm wondering if Lee would have been more vulnerable if the Democrats had fielded, say, a more establishment candidate, or was he pretty secure in his reelection?
I think that's one of the more surprising stories in politics in 2016 is that he wasn't challenged stronger, not by a Democrat, but by a Republican. Mike Lee was not the favorite of the business community in the state of Utah.
Right.
And for a long time, they were looking for someone to challenge him, someone like a Josh Romney or a John Huntsman or a Mike Leavitt or a Jason Chaffetz. And they all got asked and they all said no. And at the end of the day, when he got that Republican nomination in the state of Utah, running statewide, no Democrat has shown that they can be viable. None. In a long time. So Misty, when she got to the general election, she was a realist. She knew that she wasn't going to win. What made Misty interesting is that she got the nomination from a more conservative, traditional Democratic candidate in these races, a marriage therapist right. who was Mormon and more conservative in his political views. And that's why she ran. She ran because she wanted someone who was more of an ideological Democrat, a Bernie Sanders Democrat, as Dave said. And her success surprised the Democratic Party, but they did it. She did it by the power of personality, by her voice, by the way she went and spoke about what she believed in, and she caught fire, and it was kind of fun to watch.
Tim, you got to tell them about our encounter with her at the editorial board meeting. I mean, she got very animated, very fiery, passionate when she was said when we asked her basically. So, should you moderate a little bit? Not even.
She could have had better command of the issues than any of the candidates we talked to. She was amazing, frankly. She should run again for something. She aimed too high, but she was being able to take it from that grocery checker point of view, but still have all the big ideas in her head. It was very impressive. It made her a very impressive Democratic candidate, although, you know, Democrat in Utah. She's got to bite off a smaller chunk. She's got to stay in Salt Lake County. She's got to, you know, do something like that if she really wants to go somewhere. But yeah, when she was in that editorial board meeting, she was very much that the person she took on more than anybody else was Doug Owens.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
And Doug Owens, you know, classic example of the Democrat trying to play the middle and getting nowhere. It's almost like if you're a Democrat, do you want to lose with honor or lose without it? Because you're going to lose either way.
His was the most competitive race, I'm sure, for Democrats obviously at the statewide level against Mia Love, a rematch, and again filling a seat that had traditionally gone to Jim Matheson, and who had played, I think, that same centrist or even further right-hand side of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, and it almost to the point where, you know, how much of a Democrat are they? I suppose that in many ways, once they got back there, they would probably vote with their party and they would do that sort of a thing. But it's sort of what you have to go through. It honestly speaks more to redistricting and gerrymandering. We are a state that is gerrymandered, and most of them are.
Deputy Editor Tim Fitzpatrick, there are a lot of contenders for top stories of the year, and we will have to visit a bunch more beyond politics, but we're going to have to right now take a quick break. Much more to come here on Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, deputy editor Tim Fitzpatrick, senior managing editor Matt Canham, and managing editor Dave Noyce. Join us with your comments and questions calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. And I want to pivot away from politics now. Late in the game, but I suppose long expected bit of news, the declaration of the Bears Ears National Monument that occurred this week. We've been hearing about this for a long time, haven't we, Dave?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, we ran the year in review the day before he named it. So, But I did sense that that could come, so we certainly wrote it that way. The whole dispute about federal lands and Utah trying to take control of 31 million acres here, I think in the past year really focused more on this national monument. Will he or won't he declare a national monument? And there were so many sides to this. Each side claiming Native Americans really desired this or desired that, what locals really did want or didn't want, what a national monument would or would not actually do and inhibit or preclude. Lots of information, lots of misinformation, frankly. And so I don't think anyone's really stunned when President Obama did it. I know a lot of people are focusing on the symbolism of how and where he did it. He did it while on vacation in Hawaii. Seems to even go beyond how President Clinton declared the Grand Staircase when he did it from the Grand Canyon.
Right.
So that a lot of people are focusing on that, too.
Well, conservationists pretty happy about this. Tribes who had petitioned for this monument, happy as well. State leaders and some San Juan County residents are pretty unhappy about this, obviously.
Well, San Juan County even appears a bit divided, too, as it often is. If you go to Blanding, Monticello areas, the opposition is much stronger, and in Bluff, much less so, a tourism-related place, so...
You know, an effort by Utah Representative Rob Bishop and by Representative Jason Chaffetz aimed to sort of preempt this designation, and that was they had the Public Lands Initiative.
That's right.
The PLI legislation that would have enacted protections or some protections for some of these lands. That didn't make it through Congress, though.
No. You had a Republican Congress, and it still had a hard time getting through, which just shows how hard it is to make law, especially big law on environmental issues where the lines are drawn in the sand pretty deeply. Representative Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz had a pretty massive bill, and Bears Ears was a part of it. Their proposal would have protected about 1.2 million acres, but did it in a way that the tribes looked at as hostile to what they were trying to do. Did not go as far as they wanted. They didn't feel included in that process. They felt it was more skewed to county commissioners and ranchers and energy companies, and so they did not participate. And when you did that, when they withdrew, that really kind of killed the potential for that bill. It didn't get through the House, let alone get to the Senate, where it would have had no chance because of Democratic opposition. And so what the White House did is they waited till Congress had run out of opportunities. They had given up for the year. They're done. So the White House can say, we gave Congress as much time as we possibly could. They didn't act, so we are going to act. And what the Bears Ears National Monument is a mixture of what the tribes wanted and what Rob Bishop put in his bill. It's a mixture.
We've got a pretty good map. If you go to sltrib.com, it shows the outlines of where the Intertribal Coalition wanted to have a protected area, where the PLI would have protected, and what eventually ended up happening as the Bears Ears National Monument. I find that map really telling.
Very useful. Mm-hmm. And you can see the changes that were made. In the wake of this designation, State Attorney General Sean Reyes says that he will sue over this action, that he'll essentially challenge the designation in the courts. In the meantime, on the other side, there's a lot of celebrating going on over cultural and natural resources being protected. I'm not certain who to pose this question to, but litigating over national monument designations I've not seen that done before.
It's going to be tough. It's been attempted before, not successfully. It's legislatively is probably the only way it could really happen. And that is, I think, at least possible, but not necessarily probable. Chaffetz talks about investigating it. Stewart talks about starving it through appropriations. Neither will make it go away. It would just, frankly, just make it a worse monument, not a non-monument. So if they were to target it instead of going after the whole Antiquities Act, but just try to go after this one monument that only lived for 30 days or whatever it is, Maybe. But what's kind of telling to me is that Trump has been quiet. He who loves to tweet, he hasn't, and he also loves to dump on Obama right now. So it was kind of a fat pitch there, and he didn't take it. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? I mean, you know, like everything with Trump, you can't predict. But it was interesting to me that he didn't jump on this. Mm-hmm. I think my guess is, and it's only a guess, is that the monument will stick around.
And I'm actually surprised that Reyes didn't have a lawsuit ready to go. I mean, it's not like this has been in a vacuum and a surprise. I mean, we've been expecting this for months.
It's sort of like suing to regain the lands. You can find lawyers who will tell you they can win. And if you pay them, they'll try.
That's right.
Well, listeners, we want to hear your opinions on the stories that we are covering today as part of our 2016 Year in Review. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. I want to turn now to a story that's kind of close to all of you, an important journalism story, the purchase, some might even say the rescue, of the Salt Lake Tribune by the Huntsman family. Paul Huntsman, the son of billionaire businessman and philanthropist John Huntsman Sr., bought the Tribune, and before that it had been owned by a hedge fund in New York, but no longer. Jennifer or Tim, how important is it? How much of a difference does local ownership make for this institution?
Oh, it's pretty much everything, wouldn't you say, Tim? I mean, we really did feel like we were on the brink. That was it. It was not, there was no happy ending to this story. And then when the Huntsmans finalized the sale, came in, took selfies with Bagley, everything changed. I mean, there was obviously some questions, some trepidation, but I think an overwhelming sense of relief that, you know, we're not going to close tomorrow, which is terrific.
The hedge fund, here's one to watch. This St. Paul Pioneer Press, that is owned by the same people that used to own us. Watch them ride that thing into the ground. Mm. That was going to be us. Wow. They don't really have a sustaining strategy. They have a declining industry strategy. And they sell off the assets. They milk the thing till it's dead. Mm. That was going to be us. So this rescue was indeed a rescue.
A rescue. You mentioned questions, Jennifer. I'm going to bring them up. The Tribune has been seen as an important antagonizer to power structures in Utah. That is, of course, part of the nature of what a journalist does, journalism in general. But part of that power structure here is the LDS Church. There were fears that after this purchase was finalized, that a new day would dawn for how the paper covers Mormonism, because the Huntsmans are members of that faith. I mean, how do you address that fear? It doesn't look like that's materializing. That's me editorializing, though.
I don't know. Dave, you're our Mormon guru. I guess I haven't seen that influence at all.
No, I haven't seen us put the Articles of Faith on the front page yet.
So, no, we still have a very different sensibility than our competitors.
As a matter of fact, you know, the message to us was keep on keeping on, and to continue to aggressively cover the LDS Church as an institution and a power player in the state. And I think we've continued to do that. So,
Tim Fitzpatrick.
It's you have to go back about 100 years to really see the Tribune as being anti-Mormon.
Right.
Through the period before the Huntsmans owned us, we were always in an independent voice. That's what we do. And we are skeptical, but we weren't anti-Mormon.
Right.
And Mr. Huntsman realized that.
How has the paper, I mean, we'll get on to other topics here shortly, but how has the paper changed in the wake of the new ownership? What's happening at the paper? I know that there were some, you know, raises and some changes that were made. And then also, what's kind of on the horizon for the Tribune?
Well, 2017 is, I think, going to be a really exciting time to work for the Salt Lake Tribune and for this entire community. We're going to be revamping all of our digital platforms, and you'll see that before the half of the year is over, which is terrific. We are also expanding our staff. That is not something we've done for a very long time. So some new faces coming into the newsroom. I think just a renewed sense of optimism, which will give a jolt to our reporters to be even more aggressive, to be more creative. And we're going to remain the leader in this arena for sure. I'm not expecting any change there.
Well, optimism after some truly difficult years for journalism in general around the country. We'll have to save that conversation for a longer radio documentary at some
Excellent.
Point, because there's a lot to cover on this year in review. And I want to turn to a topic that has produced some incredible and poignant and at times difficult journalism this year. It's important reading in the Salt Lake Tribune. That topic is sexual assault, particularly campus sexual assault. A lot of coverage and some very courageous victims coming forward to tell their stories. Among them, the Salt Lake Tribune's Utahn of the Year. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, tell us about Maddie Barney and why she was chosen for this honor.
Maddie was unanimously chosen from our editorial board. I mean, basically, she is the one who opened this entire conversation up in Utah in a completely different way. She spoke out at a rape awareness forum back in April and really just changed everything. She initiated a real hard look at the policies that BYU had in place, through its honor code. Campus rape became a topic throughout the state of Utah, and it's because one person stepped forward. I mean, it was just an easy award to give, because her contributions are significant and they will be lasting.
Tim, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, there are times when in this business when we are like a pinprick on a balloon, and this was one of those cases where it was just ripe, and particularly with regard to BYU and its honor code. This was after our first story, there was like this outpouring, and including a protest that, of course, was held off campus. And eventually it led to actually BYU changing its policy. There's another person who was really very key in that, and that is Julie Valentine. You have to have somebody like her on the inside, and that was really crucial in them seeing what they needed to do and doing it, and they made a lot of progress. But yes, Maddie Barney and others, they were the ones who really walked out on a ledge, and frankly, they're still out on that ledge.
Mm-hmm. Of course. And a reminder, before Maddie stepped forward and before changes were implemented eventually after a lot of reporting and a lot of, as you said, protests, the BYU had been investigating for honor code violations, students who were reporting sexual assault in some instances, if I understand that. Really interesting changes. So, as you said, changes were made at BYU. That has gone away. The honor code investigation doesn't happen. There's a sort of amnesty for people who report sexual assault from honor code investigations. And that's been seen as making it easier for victims to step forward in this case. So
I think it'll be pretty interesting to see how this plays out, if survivors will still feel safe enough to come forward. I mean, a lot is riding on their perception within the BYU culture of what role they had in their rape. You know, I think that's going to take a much longer time to change those perceptions. But it will change over time, definitely.
One other thing I'd just like to say has to do with, this isn't all just about the colleges. What we found is a lot of dysfunction in police departments and in prosecution, particularly in Cache County and Logan and North Logan, right, with how they handled Tory Greene. I mean, the college made mistakes, but honestly, probably the city and the county made more.
And again, this is Tory Greene, a former Utah State University football player, accused of a number of rapes. This is a story where Tribune reporting actually helped kind of jumpstart criminal investigations, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, there's a very square, a head-on look at rape culture by the Salt Lake Tribune. Some very in-depth and impactful reporting. You can find it at sltrib.com. And it's actually hard for me not to loop back around to, I mean, talking about rape culture, to politics. And again, we talked about those kind of notorious comments from the president-elect now in the Access Hollywood video, where he was essentially talking about a form of sexual assault. He won the election in spite of those comments, and that says a good deal about the kinds of challenges that people like Maddie Barney have to face when it comes to combating rape culture in locally and at the national level. You can see Maddie in her own words in a video at the Salt Lake Tribune's website. Maddie Barney, the Salt Lake Tribune's Utahn of the Year for 2016. We're going to have to take another quick break here, but when we come back, homelessness in Salt Lake City and public corruption charges that stuck and those that didn't. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Tim Fitzpatrick, Matt Canham, and Dave Noyce. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions by calling us at 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. We're trying to pack a year into an hour, and that's proving a bit difficult, but a major story here in Salt Lake City this year, homelessness in the Rio Grande neighborhood and elsewhere. To try to tackle the problem, or at least make a greater dent in the problem, the city struck upon a new strategy, and that was dispersed site homeless shelters. And that's something that played out over this past year. We learned about the location of these shelters just recently, actually, Matt Canham.
Yes, this was a very secretive process. And the city council and the mayor came together and picked four sites where these shelters, about 150 beds each, will be. There were a lot of people who expected them to be on the west side of Salt Lake City because that's where these things tend to go. They feel dumped upon. They weren't. They were more centralized and maybe even a little bit on the east side, closer to 7th East. And there were four sites picked, and they're going to have different goals. So one will be a women's and families shelter. One will be a women's shelter. Two will be for men. They haven't picked which ones those are going to go. And as you can expect, people did not really like these anywhere near their neighborhoods.
Which is probably, I mean, a predictable response, and maybe part of the reason that the process was as secret as it was, because had you announced in advance a process for site selection, you would have had a lot of opposition wherever you were going to put these shelters.
Of course, but I mean, I still don't think that's justification for a closed process. I'm just fundamentally appalled by how the city has handled this whole thing, especially the mayor. And I think that residents are justified in being fed up and curious about why they were not involved at all, at all.
Yeah, and oh, go ahead, Matt.
I was just going to say, part of the consequence of doing it this way is that the emotional reaction to hearing that a homeless shelter is going to be in your neighborhood, it allows these residents to make immediate comparisons to what we see down near in the Road Home in downtown Salt Lake City, which is not a good situation by any means. And the city is now trying to say, but let us tell you what this is going to be. If you want to educate people on what you're going to do, it would have been more effective probably to do it ahead of time than afterward when they're already angry about it moving into their neighborhood.
Well, the city says that, that part of its strategy is also more aggressively trying to help people out of homelessness. And to that end, they're employing a different term for these locations, not homeless shelters, but homeless
resource centers.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Do we know what the backbone of that new strategy is?
So the idea is if you have a smaller group of homeless people in one area, you can track them more individually. You can give them more individualized services for health care or job placement. And so that's kind of part of the goal. The goal is also to get homeless people away from drug traffickers, which is easier to do in one central location for drug traffickers to prey on people who have addiction issues. If you spread them out, the goal is that that will be harder and for the people who are selling drugs to easily mix in the way they can now.
Also, so the building is going to start on these new locations at some point in 2017. Will they be done before? When will they be done? Do you remember, Matt?
They're going to start coming online in 2018. But when it comes to construction and government processes, don't be surprised if it always takes a little bit longer than first anticipated. Not all four shelters will go online at the same time. They'll be staggered, in part to see what happens downtown, to see if they can actually get a better control of the situation before their goal is to close the Road Home shelter downtown. But they're not going to do that until they have a better sense of what's happening there.
Well, and it's one sort of well-reported part of the story is the fact that the Road Home holds a certain number of beds. I think it's 1,100.
It's 1,100.
1,100 beds, and the total number of beds that will be available after the construction of these, if you close the road home as well, will decrease by 500.
Yes. And the city leaders and county leaders are saying a new strategy will be more effective, and that alone will reduce the number of people in homelessness. Advocates for the homeless community and service providers are skeptical of that. And so we will see how that plays out. Homelessness in Salt Lake City and in Utah will be one of our primary focuses in 2017, as it should be.
Okay. Well, you know, and there have been comments by people. I saw, I can't think of her name, homeless advocate.
Pamela Atkinson.
Thank you, Pamela Atkinson. All of the editors of the Tribune correct at getting me the information that I need, saying that she's never seen as many people sleeping outside in recent times as she is seeing now in Salt Lake City.
And she's frequently said, you know, she's never felt personal concerns about her safety. Now she does. Mm-hmm. And again, it's part of that that drug influence. The addiction is so high. It's not just people down on their luck. It really is fueled by an economy that is dangerous.
You know, I'm thinking about the location actually of the Salt Lake Tribune, where you guys are, and not far from the homeless shelter. Does it impact you on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, of course. There's panhandlers, which we assume many of them might be homeless. I obviously don't know. There's a couple of panhandlers I got to know. One of them, I call him the best red panhandler I've ever seen. He's always reading a novel outside of the gateway while he's asking for money. So you do see that, you know, and it's there. And of course, it raises questions about business influence as far as some of these decisions too. As you know, Gateway has new owners pumping big money into the Gateway, trying to revive and change its focus a little bit. And so, you know, that brings up issues.
Well, it's the city, meanwhile, is going to employ a new strategy. And in the coming years, we will see how it fares. We have, again, a lot of stories to get through. And I'm sorry to keep rushing us along. But a story that carried over from last year and from the year before that, for that matter, the saga of former Utah Attorneys General Mark Shurtleff and John Swallow, both faced with a number of corruption charges stemming from their time in office, charges related to alleged influence peddling, bribery, obstruction of justice. In the end, one of the two former AGs essentially walked away from those allegations that he was facing. Is that right, Dave?
Yeah. We've been following this for a long time now, it seems like. But several cases kind of went away during the year. Mark Shurtleff, case was dismissed, interestingly, not only at the request of the defense, which you would expect, but also the request of the prosecutor, citing a Supreme Court ruling that had come down that will make it harder to convict and even prosecute someone on public corruption charges, but also citing mainly the lack of cooperation from the federal government in turning over investigative documents that not only could strengthen the prosecution's case, but also perhaps provide exculpatory evidence for the defense. And so he felt compelled to dismiss that case. So the judge went along, declared her own ruling, and dropped those charges. Another case went away because of the death of one of the players. Tim Lawson, who was sometimes dubbed Mark Shurtleff's fixer, right, died. He was not healthy, and he died at a relatively young age. So that case is gone. He was the first person charged in this scandal. Mm-hmm. Jeremy Johnson, who sort of started the whole thing, was tried and convicted on 8 federal charges, although the jury threw out another like 78 of them, I guess. So he's now serving time in a federal prison in California. The one case left now is John Swallow, set for trial in February.
Well, and his lawyers had asked for the charges against him to be dropped. That didn't happen. They were basing that request on a Supreme Court ruling in Virginia, I think.
Yes, and sort of citing some of the same things about lack of federal cooperation. There's a different prosecutor in this case, though. Prosecutor in this case is Sim Gill's office. It's a little different dynamic, but some of the same arguments are surfacing.
Well, there's this fascinating kind of offshoot from the story that the Trib's Tom Harvey and Jennifer Doebner have been chasing down. It has to do with Jeremy Johnson, who you mentioned, one of the businessmen that the two AGs were accused of accepting gifts from in exchange for favors. That's the sort of allegation. But the story is that of a $2 million check, which may have been intended as a bribe for Nevada Senator Harry Reid. The stories on this read like the outline of a John Grisham novel. I mean, they're really interesting, and we don't have time to dig in really deeply here, but I'll just throw that out there as recommended reading for 2016, yeah. If you have a second. Guys, we have another just 2 minutes before we go to our underplayed stories of the year segment, and I think I'll let the editors in front of me take charge. We've covered the election, the Bears Ears National Monument, the purchase of the Tribune, campus sexual assault, homelessness, public corruption case lingering from the previous Attorney General. Where should we go with the 2 minutes remaining now that I've spent half of it talking right there?
What's left? There's so much.
Air quality, food stamp fraud, fake news, maybe.
Well, and there's lots of things. We had two police officers who passed away. We had a new theater open up, the Eccles Theater
two
in
new
downtown.
Theaters,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And one down in St. George. There is a lot packed into this year.
Let's not forget algal blooms.
Right.
I mean, really.
Yes, exactly.
I think those images will just be seared into my memory for a long
impressive.
Time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Bright green. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, lots of stories and, again, lots of coverage to see at sltrib.com. A year in an hour, hard to do. We are, of course, coming out of time and need to turn to our slightly modified version of the regular segment. Instead of underplayed stories of the week, we'll do underplayed stories of the year. And Jennifer Napier Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor, have you got one?
You have to start with me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You? Well, I love census data, and this one was a story from July. So Utah Latinos, now more than 400,000 live in the state of Utah, and that is one in every seven residents. And so the demographics are changing wildly, and I think that that is a story that doesn't get enough attention and something that we'll be turning to in 2017.
Wow. Okay, so changing demographics in Utah. Tim Fitzpatrick, what is your pick for underplayed story of the week, if you've got one?
Actually, Jennifer stole mine.
I
was going to go with algal blooms. I think that essentially what the algae in Utah Lake is telling us is that we need to pay more attention to water quality, all the way to spending millions of dollars to there are eight public sewage plants that expel into Utah Lake. Mm. We are not cleaning it enough. And it's literally our own waste, our own human waste, that is producing these algal blooms because we're not spending enough money. Global warming being what it is, we have to pay a lot more attention to cleaning up our water.
Okay. That human waste and also agricultural runoff is another
factor. Although it's more human waste, interestingly enough.
Matt Canham, underplayed story of the week. Thanks, Tim, by the way.
We've had a lot of talk about the relationship between communities and the police department, and there's been a lot of protests about it. What's interesting, and I think underplayed, is that there has been efforts in Salt Lake City to bridge that gap. There's twice weekly meetings between activists worried about police brutality and the police department. And I think that's one thing that we should probably try to follow up on is what progress they have made, because they have made significant progress in the last few months.
Well, conversations being had, too, which is remarkable.
Right.
Yeah. Great. Matt Canham for his pick. Dave Noyce, your pick for underplayed story of 2016.
Well, for me, 2016 will forever be remembered as the year my Chicago Cubs won the World
Series.
But underplayed story, and it wasn't really underplayed so much as an issue, I think, that we need to pay more attention to. I worked with a reporter, Mariah Noble, on a story recounting the voyage of a refugee from Sudan, Philip Aguto, who fled his war-torn country when he was 7 years old, walked through 500 miles of dangerous jungle, fending off crocodiles and lions and other things and marauders and rebels, finally gets to Utah and ends up dying in the middle of the night, getting hit by two cars on a street in Salt Lake City, destitute and lonely. Mm-hmm. So he survives all these terrible things in Africa and dies here that way. And the refugee story is a huge national story, an international story, worst crisis since World War II. And there are so many thousands, and each one has an individual story that's compelling.
Really interesting. A great pick for underplayed story of the year. And thanks for that, Dave Noyce, as well. For my part, I'm going to go with the another environment story, actually, another water story, the case of the vanishing Great Salt Lake. In October, the lake reached its lowest recorded level, and that's the result of drought, But also the result of the way that river water that would otherwise run into the lake is being used. And NASA's Earth Observatory site released side-by-side images of Farmington Bay, one that was from 2011, one from 2016, and the contrast is very stark. There's reporting on an increase in dust storms as a result of that drying up lake bed and the impact that that has on snowpack. Also, millions of birds that use the lake as a stopover point on their migration between hemispheres, and how this decrease in water is negatively impacting industries on the lake as well. I think that this is something we'll be talking about for some time to come. Tim?
Flying into the airport from the north is kind of amazing. You fly, the lake looks nothing like it used to look. Yeah. It's a puddle out there in the middle. And it will have very profound effects on plans to try to dam the Bear River so that for future water use. Honestly, we really can't.
One of two big infrastructure projects that the legislature is considering related to water. All right, guys. Well, we have come to the end of the hour, and I just want to thank you for being here for this year in review. Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce, deputy editor Tim Fitzpatrick, and managing editors Matt Canham, David Noyce, thank you very much for being here as part of the show today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Happy New Year.
You're welcome. Thanks.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. Many thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. Coming up next, if you're listening to KCPW, we've got KCPW Presents and Ken Rudin's Political Junkie, looking at what else? The past year in politics. So stay tuned for that on KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great weekend and a very happy new year. We'll see you again in 2017.